Hi everyone, my name's Julie Kavanagh. I'm one of the cardiologists at Paragon and I'm here today with Chris Linney, another cardiologist, and we are going to have a chat about DCM in dogs, so dilated cardiomyopathy. What is it, how we diagnose it, and how we can screen for this disease in the general population. So shall we start with some definitions? So what do we mean, Chris, when we talk about DCM?
So I think whenever you think of DCM, we are talking probably about a dilated heart that's poorly contractile, remembering that there are many different things that can do that. When we think about true DCM, we have to have excluded lots of other potential causes, because true DCM is a disease of the heart muscle. Heart muscle becomes weaker, becomes poorly contractile, and we then see signs of systolic dysfunction and eventually maybe congestive heart failure too. So the most common form that we might see is our idiopathic DCM, and that's the one that we see in many breeds, lots of large breed dogs. But the actual diagnosis to get to that is a diagnosis of exclusion. So we have to have excluded a long list really of things too. So first off is make sure that there isn't any underlying congenital heart disease that could make the heart dilated. So for example, a PDA can give you a DCM phenotype, looks like DCM, but really isn't. We can have things like infections. So myocarditis, for example, may give you a poorly contractile heart. Toxins, and more recently there's a buzz around nutrition, and then also dogs that have very fast heart rates. For example, a dog that has a heart rate of over 200 for 2 weeks is very likely to develop a DCM phenotype, a tachycardia induced cardiomyopathy, which when you treat the tachycardia, the cardiomyopathy can resolve and go back to normal.
Yeah,
I think the challenge that we have is how do you initially kind of decide which dogs we're going to look at trying to diagnose and screen?
Yeah, I think another thing just worth mentioning, that idiopathic DCM, so the true DCM that you're mentioning, Chris, is the most common cause of congestive heart failure and sudden death in mid and large breed dogs. And I guess the breeds that we know, have a over representation of DCM, I think the classic one that everyone would think of is the Doberman Pinscher. And actually, wasn't it more than half of Dobies are believed to have?
Yeah,
something like that on a recent study. But we also have breeds like Boxers, then our giant breeds like Great Danes, Newfoundlands, Irish Wolfhounds. But there are also some smaller dogs that are also predisposed. The classic one you always read about is a Portuguese water dog. I don't know if I've ever actually seen one.
Yes, like a black scruffy mongrel. I don't know that I've necessarily seen one with juvenile DCM, but yeah.
Are there lots of them in Portugal?
I don't know.
And Cocker Spaniels, I guess, are the other smaller breed that can be affected. I guess when we think about DCM, we often think about, as you said, this dilated weak heart. But we also should keep in mind that part of the disease process is actually arrhythmias too, and sometimes arrhythmias may be the first sign of DCM actually with a normal echo.
The first sign might be sudden death. Yeah. You know, some of those breeds, like the poor Great Danes that, you know, the owners wake up or is running around the field and it suddenly drops dead, probably have DCM.
Probably.
A bit like the Dobies, it's about 50% of UK Great Danes have DCM. And I think when we are considering, when are we going to look at these patients? The first thing is probably looking at the staging. So when we look at mitral valve disease, you're probably all familiar with the ACVM staging for mitral valve disease. Similar type of staging has been proposed for cats, and also been used as a proposal for dogs. So there is this staging of an A, B, C, and D for DCM. Can you talk us through that, Julie?
Yeah, so stage A, I guess, is very similar to myxomatous mitral valve disease in that this is a dog with a normal heart, but it is an at-risk breed. So, you know, classic Doberman Pinscher is a stage A. And I guess the reason for staging those dogs is that you're then aware that this is a dog at an increased risk, and it might be worth considering yearly screening these dogs for DCM. The age recommended is starting around 3 or 4 years of age, that is, because obviously this is an acquired disease, not a congenital disease. So it's kind of pointless to screen them younger than that. And I guess particularly if they're a breeding dog, so they're going to produce more more Doberman Pinschers, for example, then it's worth assessing them. So that stage A is a healthy dog, but is an at-risk breed. And then just like, again, with mitral valve disease, stage B has subcategories, so B1 and B2. And stage B1 is a dog with a structurally normal heart on echo, but they have arrhythmias that would suggest that they have underlying DCM. So that'd be stage B1. And then stage B2 is when we are seeing echo changes. So we're seeing our dilated weak heart, but we don't have symptoms of congestive heart failure. So that's stage B2. So they are, I guess, previously you may have heard the term occult DCM. So that stage B would be considered occult or preclinical. So what about stage C and D then, Chris?
Well, C, it's an easy one for me, actually, isn't it? C, it's easy for my small brain. C for congestion. So C is your congestive heart failure patients.
Yeah.
These are the ones that have tipped from being those occult or preclinical cases into the clinical congestive heart failure signs. Now, I say congestive heart failure, but with DCM, you can always have forward failure too. So I think a lot of the time we see these patients come in, we see the clinical signs of respiratory distress from pulmonary edema, tachypnea, dyspnea, but often because of their poor systolic function, they may have other signs that the owner can look back and go, well, it was lethargic, it was exercise intolerance, it's not been quite as energetic as it has been previously. And those might be signs of forward failure. And we treat the congestive ones or the stage C patients with our typical medications. There are kind of there's good data to support most of the treatments that we use, but I would be thinking about pimobendan and furosemide for all of our DCM patients. I would probably also be considering spironolactone and ACE inhibitors, but you will find that varies between cardiologists. And then you've got your stage D, which is very similar to mitral valve stage D, which is your end stage dogs that are requiring kind of a ramping up of their therapeutic regime to keep their clinical signs under control. I think the challenge that we have, like, is probably our stage A. How do we manage those stage A dogs? What do we do with them? And I think you kind of touched on talking to the owners if they're planning to breed from them. I guess, does the stage A dogs, does that include the dogs with a murmur?
No, my understanding is that there will be no signs of heart disease at all. So they would have a normal ECG, normal echo. They are simply a breed that has an increased risk. And I suppose if we're saying that with Dobermans and Great Danes, that, you know, more than 50% of the population out there are going to develop DCM, that probably is good justification to strongly encourage these owners to start screening the dogs, because I guess potentially early intervention with an antiarrhythmic, if arrhythmias are identified, could maybe reduce the risk of sudden death, or potentially early therapeutic intervention with pimobendan, if we find them as a stage B2, potentially could be helpful, although I guess the data on that is very much only for Doberman Pinschers right now, but we do extrapolate that to our other breeds. One thing I was just thinking when you were discussing congestive heart failure, so stage C, often in big dogs, their breathing rates are not as high as our small mitral valve dogs.
Fair point.
So we do see them with active congestive heart failure, pulmonary edema, with respiratory rates, mid-30s. So it's just something to keep in mind that they're not always as obvious as our small mitral valve patients.
I think the only other thing about stage C, these are the symptomatic patients. So I guess it will also include those animals that are symptomatic for arrhythmias too. So you might be considering patients that are on antiarrhythmics as being clinically affected too. And they probably would fall under stage C if they were clinically relevant, or are they still considered a cult?
That is a good question that I don't know the answer to. Yeah. If they're having syncope, you mean? Yeah. I mean, I think they'd still be, I think maybe they become stage B2. If they're having syncope, but I think that C is only for congestive heart failure.
Yeah, so this is referred to as the overt stage of DCM.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. There you go. We are kind of bounce off each other at the moment.
And learn as we go. So I guess another thing worth mentioning is that there are some I guess with some breeds, we are aware of some genetic mutations, and it's testing for those mutations is not widely performed. But so far, there are two separate mutations that have been identified in Doberman Pinschers, and the striatin mutation in Boxers have been linked with DCM. These, yeah, are not commonly, these tests are not commonly performed. I believe they're very expensive, and also they're not the whole picture. So you could have a Doberman that is negative for those mutations but still has DCM. So I suppose I don't think genetic screening replaces the need for echocardiography and Holter monitoring.
I guess you can also be positive with the gene. You can have the kind of the positive mutation for the gene, but not actually express the condition too. So,
exactly.
You know, like sometimes you can open a whole can of worms. It's a bit like being genetically tested if you've got something in your family history and you're then living with a time bomb that may never happen.
To know.
Yeah, maybe.
yeah. Okay. So,
I guess then we're then thinking we have a patient that we want to investigate and we want to screen and assess for DCM. Where do you start? What do you usually start with?
I mean, I suppose obviously we have the luxury of the equipment and our residency training, that the ideal test of choice would be both an echocardiogram and a Holter monitor. But if we're considering all modalities that we have and what might be available to vets in practice, you can run an ECG. So sometimes dogs with a big dilated heart will have atrial fibrillation. So you may see an irregular rhythm with no P waves, consistent with atrial fibrillation, that can lead you to suspicion this dog has underlying DCM. You may also see some ventricular premature complexes, so wide and bizarre complexes. Ideally, to assess the number and the complexity of those VPCs, a Holter would be much better. But actually, there was a study that suggested if you had more than one VPC on a 5-minute ECG trace, then it was likely that you had more than 100 VPCs over a 24-hour period on Holter monitor. So there may be some utility for an in-house 5-minute ECG, although it absolutely wouldn't replace a Holter as the gold standard. Holter would be best test for rhythm analysis. There are specific criteria for, at least for Dobermans and for Boxers, for what would be considered abnormal. So for Dobermans, I think it's over 300 VPCs in 24 hours. For Boxers, it's probably similar. Maybe they say 100 to 300 in 24 hours is suspicious and over 300 is likely. But I guess in addition to just the number of the VPCs, if you're seeing, you know, couplets, triplets, or any runs of ventricular tachycardia, that's probably much more alarming and much more suggestive of underlying DCM versus lots of single VPCs. So keep in mind, it's not just the number, but also the complexity of these.
I think just to add to that then, Julie, I think the other thing would be thinking about just kind of slightly off topic, VPCs on their own. So like if we see VPCs and we have echo changes, we'll probably put the two together. But just from being sort of mindful that VPCs can be seen with non-cardiac disease as well. And I think that's kind of an important one. If you get a Holter and there's lots of VPCs, yes, it could be DCM, but probably need to almost take a step back to think, well, is this dog otherwise healthy? Do we need to look at bloods? Should we be considering screening for other kind of abdominal pathology, you know, splenic tumours, liver tumours, any type of systemic disease may cause you to get VPCs just with the heart being so sensitive to other things going on in the body. But yeah, I think those criteria kind of, you know, from the number of VPCs, we're generally kind of doing the echo and the Holter. The Holter being more important perhaps in those breeds that are prone to arrhythmias as part of their DCM, like you said, the Dobie, the Great Dane, the Boxer. But there'll be other breeds, potentially like Labradors, where they get DCM and they don't necessarily get quite as much ventricular arrhythmias that we need to manage. So kind of it's important for you to take a holistic view of the case. And if you do a Holter and you want some help or some advice with reviewing the Holter, that's probably something we'd be very happy to support and help with, because it's not the easiest thing to sift through all the data and all the number of VPCs. You can get kind of really focused on, well, this time we did an ECG and it had like 1,000 VPCs and now it's got 950, but so what, that there's 50 less. So just having somebody that looks at them all the time can be really helpful. Just, and we're happy to do that and to help.
Yeah, it's a good point that the day-to-day variability of VPCs can be massive. So yeah, it's another thing to be aware of. What about chest x-rays? So something that the vets could do in-house, but would they be useful for screening for DCM?
I think the challenge for screening for DCM, perhaps clinical DCM, there may be a role in it. Thinking of a dog that has clinical signs of respiratory distress, mm-hmm. and you're trying to understand, is it related to cardiogenic disease or could it be non-cardiac disease? I think that's when the radiographs come into their own. But for screening for DCM itself, the radiographs are very poorly sensitive and specific really for DCM. It's a condition where you may see very little change to the cardiac silhouette, but you may still have an abysmal function of the ventricle. So you don't necessarily pick up much from a radiograph. And the only exception I'd say is if that dog is clinically affected with respiratory signs and you want to say, well, is there congestion or not, then radiographs still remain the gold standard. Although I guess in our clinic, we often go with what we see on the echo, the clinical status of the dog, and the presence of ultrasonographic changes in the lungs as well. Mm-hmm. But I think radiographs for DCM as a rule probably have limited value. I don't know what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. And I guess in a big dog, they're not the easiest to achieve either. You're going to need probably fairly heavy sedation or general anesthesia to get decent images. I guess another thing just to mention is that if you are using vertebral heart score, remember there are breed specific ranges. So I know we all remember, what is it, 10.5 is like the
arbitrary
for everyone, yeah. But I don't think that works for every breed, so yeah, keep that in mind.
The boxes are like 12, vertebral heart score for 12 is quite normal in a boxer. And you'd erroneously call that a dilated heart, yeah. A enlarged cardiac silhouette, yeah. I should say, let's be specific, when it's completely normal for that breed. So it's just important, like you say, be aware, yeah. that there are breed differences on that VHS.
So what about echo then, Chris? What are you looking for on echo if you're screening for DCM?
So for me, for the echo, I think the first thing is to look at it from a really subjective point of view, and think about that initial case, that clinical case that comes in. If the dog has DCM and it's clinically relevant, we're going to see a poorly functioning left ventricle. Probably won't need to do measurements to see that. We should be able to visualize a poorly functioning left ventricle. We may see a subjectively dilated left atrium as well. So I'd be looking for those two features. Usually we'll run an ECG at the same time, looking for arrhythmias, looking for VPCs, more complex ventricular arrhythmias, atrial fibrillation, APCs, for example, as well. But then they can get into the nitty gritty of looking at sort of more specific things. But I'd really say use that first impression. Don't just solely rely on the numbers. Perhaps more important when we're thinking about preclinical DCM and trying to decide, should we start a patient on treatment like medications? But I would say that starting to get into the realms of those sorts of cases probably do require someone that is doing regular echo. So I think for a preclinical DCM, I think those are challenging unless you're doing it on a daily basis. So those are sorts of cases where you might have a case thinking, is it preclinical? Is it not? Maybe worth chatting to a cardiologist or maybe even worth referral. But I think those clinical cases that come in, like we talk about those respiratory distress cases, and you see this poorly contractile left ventricle and left atrium, I think those are the key things. But we can go into like more detail and measurements. So, I said a poorly functioning left ventricle, and that could be based on the systolic function of the ventricle or purely just on the measurements of that left ventricle in terms of size. So you usually will have dilation and systolic dysfunction as well. So when we think about dilation, we can do it on our kind of our 1D measurements, like the left ventricular internal dimensions in diastole and systole. Often because it's a poorly contractile ventricle, the systolic measurement is much bigger than it should be. But the diastolic one can be increased as well with congestive heart failure. And then we'll be also thinking about the volumes of that left ventricle. If it's not contracting very well, it's not going to be ejecting blood very well either. So you have an increase in your systolic volume and your diastolic volume in the ventricle. So we call that the end diastolic and the end systolic volumes there as well. And then you can get into numbers. If you ever come and see practice, and just as a by the by, we're very happy for people to come and see practice with us as well. You will see that we won't necessarily do all the numbers and measurements to make a diagnosis. It's been shown in the human world as well that if you are a consultant doing lots of echocardiography, you can use your eyeball because you just do it so much. But I think when you're starting out, probably the numbers become more important. They're almost like a crutch for you. And I definitely would say, unless you're doing it kind of every day, and you kind of have a level of competency that would be similar to Julie's here. I won't say mine because she's more competent than me. You probably should be looking at the numbers, but really, really being critical of those numbers. If you're not getting a nice measurement, like if you're not getting a nice image and you take a measurement, well, how much error is there in your measurement as well? So kind of only measure images that are good quality. And if you're not sure whether they're good quality or not, then probably you need to kind of work on your echo skills, I'd say. It's a bit of a soapbox, so apologies for that. I'd be thinking we could look at fractional shortening and ejection fraction. And those are always the ones that are touted around, that if you've got poor function, the fractional shortening will be low. If you've got poor function, your ejection fraction will be low. That said, they can be low for other reasons too. So don't just look at those percentages, because they can be low because of systemic disease. They can be low because of anesthesia, because of medetomidine, because of drugs that we give the patients. They can be low for... just thinking, kind of lost my train of thought. They can be low just because reference values are different for different breeds as well. So, you know, a fractional shortening of, say, 17% in a Cocker Spaniel is not DCM. Heaven knows, like in the past, before we knew this, I would have treated lots of dogs with a fractional shortening of 70% and think, oh my God, that's low. I'm going to start them on Vetmedin. But we now know that every breed has its own reference values, and that wouldn't be what's low for one breed is not necessarily low for another. So being very mindful that the fractional shortening, the ejection fraction, there are breed specifics. And if you're going to diagnose preclinical DCM, you really need to look at the breed specific reference intervals, not just those arbitrary numbers that get thrown around as the normal values for these reference numbers. And there are some more kind of more complicated measurements and more complex measures that we can take. And I have been speaking for a long time, so I'm going to let Julie take over on these ones.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. What you're saying about not over-interpreting what you see. I think that another sort of scenario in which a heart can appear like a DCM phenotype is an athletic heart. So in breeds such as a very fit Springer Spaniel, often, you know, you pop the probe on and your first thought is their heart looks a little big and the pumping function doesn't look brilliant. But often it is that they are, yeah, essentially they're athletes and they don't need the same level of movement of that ventricle. So yeah, I think it's easy to over-interpret. So I think be careful labeling something as preclinical DCM, I guess, because it very much is a diagnosis of exclusion, and there are many other things that could be causing the heart to look that way on echo.
So just with that athletic comment, I guess Border Collie is very typical. English Springer Spaniels as two breeds that are very athletic type breeds, but an athletic individual in a breed could also have like reduced systolic function when you see them in the clinic. And I always kind of think as well is that if you have a really, really relaxed animal on the table and they aren't stressed and they're not secreting adrenaline and they've not got high sympathetic tone, if they've not got sort of a stimulus for increased contractility, you might find that an excited dog on the table will have different values to a really, really relaxed dog on the table. So there is kind of almost that kind of element that you have to factor in too, that it doesn't just come down to the numbers on their own.
I also think in giant breeds, sometimes that first image, which is your right parasternal long axis four chamber view.
That's the home view for those of you that have come on any of my courses.
Yeah, what do you call it?
Yeah, home view.
Often the left ventricle doesn't seem to be doing much in that view, but when you turn 90 degrees to your mushroom view or your short axis left ventricle view, it looks like it's doing a lot more. So remember that the left ventricle is twisting rather than just kind of collapsing down on itself. So often you will appreciate more movement in one direction than another. It's just another thing to mention.
So I'm going to put you on the spot, Julie, just thinking about a question. So say for example, fractional shortening is low, but an ejection fraction isn't, like, say one parameter that's abnormal, the other isn't. What do you do in those cases?
Yeah, I guess I'd never make a diagnosis based on one echo parameter. So it has to be my entire assessment. So chamber dimensions, so left ventricle, left atrium, like you said, both diastolic and systolic. If I'm going off one measurement being low, I'm not diagnosing preclinical DCM. So it very much is evidence gathering and your impression as a whole. But yes, you don't overinterpret one result that doesn't fit with the rest.
I agree. Yeah. You know, so if I have one abnormal measurement, I was just thinking, am I doing the same thing as Julie? So if it's just one measurement that's abnormal, don't go on that one measurement. Like, look at the big picture. Look at that subjective impression. Is it really dysfunctional when you look at it with your eye? And do the other measurements support it? Because if it's just one outlier in terms of the one measurement that's abnormal, I wouldn't necessarily hang a lot of information on that. Mm. Yes, maybe see it back for another assessment, see whether it's progressive, but not necessarily make a decision on that one.
Or if you think that your values are borderline and a bit equivocal and you can't quite make a diagnosis or commit to that, absolutely see it back in a few months. If it's there, it's going to be progressive and it'll be more obvious as time goes by. I absolutely get it back in a few months. It probably does take at least 3 months to see any sort of meaningful change, maybe even six. So there's no point seeing it back 2 weeks later, for example.
No.
Yeah, it's going to take a bit of time to remodel.
And there are some other measurements that we can take too. And I said we would go through those, get you to go through those. But I think those would be the keys, really. I think the ones that people should be looking at in general practice. And the other kind of layers, I always think of it like peeling the onion. Like, those are kind of the first layers of the onion. And the more echo you do, the more layers of the onion you unpeel to make these diagnoses. So we would be looking at kind of other measurements such as the E-point septal separation, sericity index, looking at tissue Doppler imaging as well, some of the kind of systolic time intervals. So lots of other things that we can look at. But I think really, when we're looking at this from the how do we manage these cases and screen for them in GP practice, I think that's probably the most important type of measurements. And I don't know what you think, Julie.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I still think end diastolic and end systolic volumes and dimensions and our parameters of systolic function are going to be the hallmarks. You know, yes, we've got other more fancy things that we can add in, but they are definitely the hallmarks. But what about, let's say you are not confident with echo, how about biomarkers? I guess the two that we have are NT-proBNP, which, as we know, is a marker of myocardial stretch. So in theory, if we had some structural changes associated with DCM, we might have an elevation in our NT-proBNP. But I guess keep in mind that there are other factors that can affect our proBNP values. So an animal with renal dysfunction is likely to have higher proBNP values, same for those with pulmonary hypertension or sepsis or systemic hypertension. Or, of course, if the sample was mishandled. I think proBNP is one that's tricky, that has to be spun down and the serum extracted. And
it slightly depends on where you send them. So there are some tubes that you can get that you don't have to do so much with them, but they need to be processed very quickly. Where you send your sample to, the process will be very different in between different labs, because a lot of the labs will then send that sample on to another one. Mm. So to keep the quality of the sample, often you'll spin it, you'll separate the plasma or the serum from the rest of the tube. That's key, is just check with your lab how they would like you to process that sample. Yeah. In fact, some places they ask you to freeze it as well. Mm. That's another complicating factor, to freeze it so it's sent on a frozen sample.
I guess it's not something that we perform that regularly, because echocardiography obviously also will assess for myocardial stretch. But there are some reported references. So in a Doberman Pinscher, having a proBNP over 550 picomoles per liter is quite suspicious for underlying DCM. If you also perform a Holter, so if you were to offer an in-house NT-proBNP check for a Doberman Pinscher and a Holter, the two together actually can increase the sensitivity and specificity of finding occult DCM in those cases. For other breeds, it's much higher. So it's over 900 picomoles per liter is what's referenced as being abnormal. Then I guess our other biomarker is cardiac troponin I, which is an indicator of cardiomyocyte lysis. So myocyte cell death, essentially. It is obviously not going to be particularly specific for DCM. I think that you'd have to have fairly advanced disease before you were seeing changes in troponin. So my feeling is the kind of usefulness of troponin using as a screening test is probably not worth doing.
Yeah, I think there's some kind of, because Dobies are the poster child for DCM, a lot of the studies are done in Dobermans. So again, thinking of like the Dobies themselves, with the new kind of high sensitivity troponin tests, there are kind of reference values and kind of levels that you'd expect to be more consistent with DCM. And like looking at the data, like a level of like 0.113 nanograms per mil, so it's a little bit of an increase over the normal value, would give you a sensitivity of 81% and a specificity of 73%. I guess we're not going into stats tonight, but in terms of a test that's going to tell you whether or not a dog has DCM, an echo is going to do that much better than that test. Yeah. So I think if you have a suspicion, the echo is going to be far superior to the NT-proBNP. The NT-proBNP. But then it's the same for the troponin too. I guess one of the reasons to consider troponin though might be in a dog where you do have signs of what looks like DCM, because one of our differentials might be myocarditis. So would it be worthwhile checking troponin for any case that you see with systolic dysfunction and a dilated heart? I guess I don't know what you think, Julia, Matt, like in terms of would you do a troponin in any case like that, or when are you choosing to run a troponin in those sorts of cases?
I mean, I guess in theory it makes sense to check them all. I suppose if you had a Doberman and you have the classic ventricular arrhythmias, common things are common. I guess it's much more likely that there is underlying DCM, but I guess it's not wrong to check in those sorts of cases.
Unusual breeds, yeah. Young animals,
those
types of things.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
And I think the one thing that we probably haven't spoken about is probably that the influence of things like systemic conditions like hypothyroidism.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing we haven't, like, just thinking about when we talked about Dobies, in terms of that systemic conditions such as hypothyroidism will reduce your systolic function. So as well as taking a good echo and doing your Holter, really important to get some baseline bloods. And if you're thinking about systolic dysfunction, particularly in those breeds that are prone to hypothyroidism, so thinking of your Spaniels, thinking of your Dobies, definitely be looking at checking thyroid levels too. Mm. Potentially even just starting with T4. If the T4 is low, it could still be sick new thyroid, and you could then follow it up with a TSH. Just thinking about saving money for the client. But you know, T4, TSH together, it gives you like the bigger picture.
Something worth mentioning on that is, I believe if you have underlying heart disease and are hypothyroid, it recommends to start supplementing thyroxine at a lower dose. I think it might be 50% of what we would normally give. It's written somewhere in Ettinger and etched in my mind since from the exams. But with those cases, we should start on a lower dose of thyroxine rather than our standard dose. And just one last thing, I guess, that I was thinking that we hadn't mentioned. I guess we did discuss, we talked a little bit about nutrition dependent DCM and grain free diets. And I guess I was going to ask what your thoughts on taurine, because I think a lot of people are aware of a link with taurine and DCM. So do you always check taurine levels in your DCM patients, and would you supplement? Do you often see improvement in echo parameters on cases that are supplemented?
So I think the holy grail is there are some papers out there looking at taurine deficiencies in Cocker Spaniels, and they showed that supplementing taurine improved their systolic function. And that's kind of probably where it comes from. Taurine is a really important kind of building block for myocardial function. And I think we can supplement it without knowing what the taurine levels are. I guess it depends on how much information does the owner want to go to, how much do you feel comfortable with not knowing or knowing. I rarely would check taurine in a dog that was on a commercial diet, because I think that should be sufficient for them, and taurine is supplemented in all the commercial diets because we know how important it is. But if you're on home-cooked diets, for example, if you have a client that's on home-cooked diets or maybe on vegan, vegetarian, there's a lot more of those than there used to be, then potentially worth checking taurine to know whether there is a low taurine, because you might find that they respond better when you treat their DCM than they would have done had they not had like a low taurine. So there might be sort of instances where I do check it, but as a rule, like think of that classical Dobie or classical Labrador on a commercial diet, I wouldn't necessarily check it in all of those. And then if the owner said to me, well, I want to do everything that I can, I would say go for your life, go to Holland and Barrett. Other health stores are available, you can probably get the taurine supplementation from there. If you want the dose, give us a shout, pop us an email, we can help you with that. I might say just give it, because if you don't need it and you pee it out, it's not a problem to have lots of taurine, it's not going to do any harm. But I think if we think about when I have clients that come in, I always kind of try and make sure they're absolutely clear in their mind that if you compare pimavendin for treating DCM versus taurine, then the pimavendin is going to do a better job than the taurine, unless you're one of those American Cocker Spaniels where it's actually been to be beneficial. Yeah.
I guess you have the option of measuring, isn't it, whole blood or plasma levels? And I think in theory, you should check both. I think that's what's recommended. I've lost my train of thought now. Taurine. Oh, yes, that was it. Sorry. So I think that if you had a truly taurine responsive DCM, that you would expect improvement of your echo parameters within, I think it's 3 to 4 months. So it does take a little bit of time after you've obviously supplemented taurine. I guess it can be tricky because if you've also started pimavendin and things are looking a little better, which is the one that's helping, that can be difficult to gauge.
From a purely kind of clinical point of view, if the systolic function was bad enough to make me feel I was going to start pimavendin, I'd put them on it. I'd put them on pimavendin and taurine. Then it's hard to know which of the two were beneficial. And for a heart that was poorly contractile, you're never going to be wrong to give pimavendin if there's no outflow tract obstruction. Yeah. So it's one of those probably like chicken and egg situations that you end up in thinking, well, was it the pimavendin? Was it the taurine? But I probably would not take that patient off of it, actually.
I was going to say, I can't think of any case I've had where I've ever took away the pimavendin because I've been so happy with how they've improved with taurine. I agree. I wouldn't withhold it. Even if you believe there to be taurine deficiency, as you said, it's going to help more than the taurine.
And I think just in terms of the grain-free, because I think that's kind of where it all started, was grain-free diets are bad. And I don't think necessarily that's specifically the grain-free. We have to kind of look a little bit deeper into those diets that are grain-free to say, well, what is the grain supplemented by? Replaced by. So it's often when they look at the ingredients in those grain-free diets, there's several culprits that come up time and time again. And there's probably more of a link, rather than saying specifically grain-free, is that if they're on like leguminous, which I still have no idea what a leguminous vegetable is, but I can tell you like things like pulses, lentils, soybeans, things like that.
Peas
as well. They're important, kind of potentially important in the role of DCM that's nutritional. And actually we know that if you can then supplement those dogs with a more commercialized diet that's not got a kind of an increased proportion of those particular leguminous vegetables, you can see response to therapy purely by starting that. But again, a lot of those dogs, often I'd be thinking, do we put them on pimavendin as well, actually? Because I think by the time we see a dog on a grain-free diet that has clinical signs, they're usually in heart failure. But there are papers out there, and there's definitely instances where you swap the diet and the congestive heart failure resolves, the ventricles normalize, the atria normalize, and you can get them off their medications. I think that those sorts of cases, probably, again, I think that's, I don't want to kind of try and tout business, but I think those are the really challenging cases. And I think probably one where it's important, even if you're not going to refer it, probably to have a chat through the case, because I think they are far and few between here in the UK. We don't see them like they did in the States, where there was that massive explosion. But we do see it from time to time, I think. And so it's like looking for the, what's called, it's not as rare as hen's teeth, but maybe looking for the needle in the haystack, that there aren't many cases, but if you suspect you have one, worth having a chat with your local cardiologist about it.
And I guess they're often an unusual breed. So they're not a breed that typically gets, or at least if you're seeing a breed that doesn't typically get DCM, so I think a lot of those cases in the States were small dogs, things like Yorkshire Terriers. So I think if you're seeing something in a breed like that, I think something like a nutritional DCM could be more likely.
So I think that kind of takes us to where we were hoping to get. We're kind of in 40 minutes.
That's all I know about DCM.
That's 40 minutes into our podcast. I guess we haven't really spoken much about the therapeutics, but that's probably a podcast for another day, I would say. We have had a podcast, if you're interested in the podcast from cardiology, there were a few previous ones. We've looked at vertebral heart score and radiographic assessment of cardiac size. We have done one on when can you go wrong with cardiac medications. So, you know, when can you make the wrong decision to start furosemide, for example, which is one that was recorded not so long ago by Debbie and I. So feel free to look to our back catalogue.
ECG review.
Don't
forget.
Don't forget your ECG. Yes, Julie's excellent at ECG. So definitely have a look at the ECG review if you're keen on learning a bit more about cardiology. And thank you for everyone's attention. We look forward to speaking to you, chatting in our next podcast.
Oh, and should we mention our next CPD evening is in the Fleece in Near Halifax.
Yeah, the Fleece, the Golden Fleece.
Golden Fleece? It's going to be the Golden
Fleece. We're going to send people to the wrong place. Yeah. But if you check our website, there is a CPD that Julie and I are doing on the 7th of December, 2023. So I'm sorry if you're listening to this after that event, you've missed it. We are doing CPD and we'd love to see as many of you there as possible.
Oh, and the topic is the top tips in cardiology. So going through a few... maybe common things that are misunderstood in cardiology, but yeah, sort of five key things that you should be aware of. And it's going to be case-based.
Cool. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.